Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Think back to your high school graduation class. There were probably jocks and brainiacs, class clowns and bumps on a log, just like every class. But did you think there was a nearly 500-page book in the lifelong exploits of your fellow classmates? Well, Ken Dryden clearly did. The Hall of Fame goaltender, Stanley Cup champion, and former cabinet minister has written a book about people he spent his formative years with, whom we don't know, but end up interested in, cheering for, and shedding a tear for when their lives face tragedy. And Ken Dryden joins us now here in the studio for more on The Class, a memoir of a place, a time, and us. Ken, it's great to have you back here in this studio.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Lovely to see you again. Well, you know, I must say, it would never occur to me that there would be a book in the people I went to high school with. What made you think there was for the folks you went to high school with?
Because I think we're all fascinated with our own question of how we got from there to here in terms of our lives. And I know that in my case, you know, that I had no idea where my life was going to end up. I had certain things that I had in mind that I thought might be in my future, and almost none of them came to pass. And most people that I know, it was the same. And I was quite sure it would be the same for our high school class. And because none of us really stayed in much contact with the others, that we didn't really know for sure. And so this was a time to find out. And it was just this terrific adventure to go on.
Now, if I may say, you look a lot younger than you are. So you better put the year out there. What year was your graduation year?
My graduation year was 1965.
Etobicoke Collegiate Institute.
That's right.
And you called yourselves the brain class.
Well, we didn't call ourselves the brain class, but others called us the brain class, which was one of those things where we were alternately embarrassed about, and at the same time, well, that's not such a bad thing. But why it came to be was that we were a specially selected class. We had taken tests during elementary school. None of us really remember taking the test, but we did. And it was on the basis of a test and also of our elementary school's teacher recommendation that we were one of 35 to go into this class. And so our first day, you know, that came from four elementary schools, we probably on average knew three or four other students going into that first day, the day after Labor Day in 1960.
Okay, here's an excerpt from the book. First one we'll do here during our conversation. Sheldon, if you would, let's put this up and I'll read along for those listening on podcast. Everyone in our high school class, all 35 of us, went to university and all but three of us graduated. We were 21, 22, 23 years old. From promise and possibility from all those years in Etobicoke at ECI, in the brain class, now we were immersed in a world of our own making. Big job decisions, big personal decisions were right in front of us that would set the course of the next big directions of our lives. Marriage or not? Kids or not? When? How many? Living where? Doing what? Big decisions indeed. How daunted do you remember yourself being at this stage of your life, facing those kinds of decisions?
I think that the big apparent decision wasn't a decision. The big thing was to go to university. And that was the spirit of that time in that place. Almost none of our parents had gone to university, but they were finding their way after World War II, and they were starting to do better in a Canada that had in front of it all of these possibilities. I mean, Europe was decimated by the war. A lot of the rest of the world, the empires were breaking up. There were newly independent countries trying to find their way. North America was in this incredibly special place of being able to create what seemed, you know, the possibility of whatever we wanted to create. And what our parents knew was the foundation of that was going to be university. And they just wanted for us to have the chance to go to university.
But you made a very unusual decision, because most kids who grew up in Etobicoke go to Western or U of T or Queens or something, or George Brown or Seneca, Humber. You went to Cornell in Ithaca, New York. How come?
Because I wanted an adventure. I wanted to go away. I didn't feel even like Western or Queens was going away. Certainly the U of T wasn't going away. And I'd always had a U.S. fascination. And I think it came from sports. That following Major League Baseball and where were all of the big league teams of the time. Following college football, where were all of those teams? And television. I mean, at the time when I was a kid, there were three television stations, and two of them were from Buffalo. And almost all the shows that we wanted to watch were on Buffalo TV. And so I had this kind of southward gaze, really, and an adventure for me was going to be going to the U.S., and the schools that I had in mind were either Cornell or Princeton, and I was going to go there.
Well, you say you look south, but you also say you were insistently Canadian while at Cornell. What does that mean?
Well, it surprised me. I mean, and I think it was because all of my classmates were Americans, and they would kind of ignore or dismiss the fact that Canada really existed and that Canadians had, mattered at all. And so, I mean, I found myself, like, whenever they would talk about anything, I'd say, Perry Mason? Raymond Burr, he's from Vancouver, And what about Bonanza? Lauren Green, he's a Canadian. And what about Paul Anka and Giselle McKenzie? Where are they all from? They're from Canada. And I would interrupt everybody when they would be talking about anything to bring up something about Canada.
I want to really take a step off the path here and ask you a very unusual question, because I've known you for a long time. This is a question about anti-Semitism. If you grew up in Toronto in the 60s, there's a good chance you're a little bit anti-Semitic. You're not. There's not a whisker of it around you. Why aren't you? That's the atmosphere you grew up in Etobicoke of the 1950s and 60s.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that we were. Maybe we were. I don't know.
I don't think you were.
The only thing that I remember is that when somebody would be talked about who was Jewish, it would always get mentioned. And so, a customer of mine, he's Jewish. But it would always be brought up that he's Jewish, and always brought up in a kind of lower voice, that as if you needed to say it, but you didn't say it at the same level, level of tone to it. I mean, in our high school class, and it would have been, in terms of religious and ethnic backdrops, it wouldn't have been much different in other classes. But we had, I think we had only one Catholic, and all of the rest were United Church, Presbyterian, Anglican. I mean, that was Etobicoke in that time, and there were in the entire school, and I went through the yearbooks and just looking at class photos, and there were out of 1,100 students in our first year and about 1,600 in our last year, there were three visible minority students. That's it.
But that was typical. It was.
Yeah. I mean, that was suburban Toronto at that particular time.
Right. Okay, back on the path here. Your team at Cornell wins the American Collegiate Hockey Championship. Mm-hmm. Was it obvious to you in achieving that you were now going to be a professional hockey player someday?
Yeah. No, it was.
Nobody's going to believe that answer.
No, I understand. I mean, and I've given the answer many times before, and I've never been believed. So I'm expecting it. No, I never thought that there was a connection between a kid playing for Humber Valley and Maple Leaf Gardens. I mean, that there was, that was another world, that was a world that was on television every Saturday night. And it on that screen were people that I didn't know, I had never met, and they were there and I was here. And it didn't matter that I was a pretty good minor hockey player and played junior B and we did well and then went to Cornell and it turned out we were better than any of us thought. At the end when, we had done really well and I was reading how the Canadians were following me and scouting me and all the rest of it. And Sam Pollock, traveled to Toronto or traveled to Ithaca to watch us play the University of Toronto. GM of the Canadians. Even when I arrived in Montreal, I can remember the first practice of going out, on the ice. And by that time, it was players like Yvan Cornoyer, Jean Béliveau, Jacques Lemaire. It's like, what am I doing here? I am going to get killed. And you just find out. That's all.
I want to ask you about a blind date that you went on. And the woman that you were on that blind date with, you apparently gave a written quiz on Canada to, because she was an American student. Whatever happened to her?
Well, we've been married for, despite all of that, for a very long time.
It's 53 years?
Yeah, that's
53
right. Yeah,
years.
Yeah.
What'd you think about that quiz idea?
Well, it didn't seem that odd to me, which again was kind of, part of the oddness of it and part of the look that I have here of kind of being kind of dorky.
What is with those ears, Ken?
Well, it took me a long time to grow into those ears.
But you did.
That was a blind date that was set up by my roommate and Linda's roommate. They were brother and sister, and they were also students at Cornell, and they just thought we should meet.
Love at first sight? You knew she was going to be the one?
I may have, but I don't think she did.
Okay, let's talk about some of your other classmates from high school, because as you mentioned, you followed them over the... You re-got in touch with them, I guess, if I can put it that way. Your class was unique in some ways and very typical in other ways. Let's talk about Lisa, who got pregnant the first time she had sex. Was that her plan?
No, it was not her plan. But Lisa is somebody who then finds answers. And as we all have to in one way or another, Lisa was a great surprise to me as I got to know her, as we started to talk in doing this book. She was this kid in high school that was really cute and who virtually every boy would have a crush on. And I thought that was kind of pretty much the beginning and the end of Lisa, that's just how she was. She was always really nice to me in a way in which, kids who are girls who are that cool aren't nice to kids like me, but she was. But she had a really interesting mother who she called by her first name, Adele, and who took her to foreign films and even films that were restricted in how the rest of our parents didn't want us to go and see, even though Lisa was underage. She wanted her to see. And that was kind of Lisa's life. She had she read interesting things, she did interesting things, and then now she was going to have to find a way. And she was with interesting people. Her partners during those years were involved in the arts. No, that wasn't part of her plan, as lots of things weren't part of our plans.
Well, let's talk about some of the other friends you had back in the day. Steve Wistance Smith dropped out of university to help found the Tarragon Theatre in Toronto. Yeah. Kathy McNabb, part of a group that established University of Toronto Radio. Right. Both of those institutions still around 50 years later. Right. Wayne Yetman, 36th best marathon runner in the world. How impactful do you think those things turn out to be in their lives ultimately?
That's a very good question. I think hugely in that way of where if you discover you can do something, then you're more likely to try the next thing, and you may not know you can do the next thing, but you may not believe that you can't. And so, somebody like Wayne, he was a distance runner at a time in high school when nobody ever wanted to be a distance runner. Bruce Kidd had just come along and he was making a name for himself and for Canadians in distance running. But for anyone else, nobody wanted to run any kind of distance. It was boring. It hurt your lungs. You didn't do it. And Wayne wasn't fast enough to be a sprinter, but he could run, and he would continue to run, and he would run cross country, and nobody wanted to run cross country because it was always raining in the fall. And he just got a little bit better and a little bit better all the time. Never had the sprinting speed, even for a marathoner to kind of find a way to, he ends up making the Canadian Olympic team in 1976. And running in the Boston Marathon and finishing high there, and turned out to be a terrific runner, and I suspect that part of that for Wayne would be, I can do stuff.
Lorna Casey has a child and then her husband dies. She's a 27-year-old widow. Marilyn Cade gets a call from her babysitter saying that her child of 5 months has died in his crib. Those two women, how were they not destroyed by those tragedies?
Because I think they knew they couldn't be. They were young, and I think, like for most of us, at a certain point, and probably at every point, things happen, and you have to decide how to understand those things. And you can either understand them in a way that where you see yourself as this is stuff that just happens to me, it always happens to me, it's always going to happen to me, I'm never going to get over this. Or for some reason, and whether it's in you, it's in the people around you and how they treat you, it's like, no, I have a life to live. I have another 50 years of my life ahead of me. And I have to find a way of living that life. That doesn't mean that my husband didn't die when I was 27 years old and left me as a single mother at that time. That is a reality of my life. It is always going to be a reality of my life. But I have to create other realities as well. And the same thing for Marilyn Cade after the death of their son is that we have to go on and continue to make a life that we were making for ourselves up until that time. Robert will always be a part of us.
That's the child.
But we also have to live our lives.
Joan Clift's daughter, Rebecca, gets cancer at the age of 3. Yeah. What got Joan through all of that?
Her religion, I think in big part it was her religion. She believed that good things could happen. And one of the things that, as context for that, is that one of the other students in our class, Murray McKenzie, his wife had been a nurse on the child cancer part of Sick Kids Hospital in the early 1970s, a few years before Joan Clift's daughter was diagnosed. And as Murray relates about his wife, who was the nurse, at that time, every kid with cancer died at Sick Kids. No exceptions, no flukes, no miracles, everyone. And what kept the nurses going and what kept the doctors going is, in part, is that we've got to try to find a way for these kids. And at the same time, with each one, we're learning. We're learning a little bit more. And by the time Joan's daughter was diagnosed with cancer, that they knew enough more that she survived.
She's 48 today.
She is.
At what point in your life do you realize, because when you graduate from grade 13 and you go off and do what all of you tried to do, you just think the world is filled with endless possibilities and it's going so swimmingly. And then, per the examples I've given here, then you come to realize, boy, real life is about taking shots almost every day and figuring out, when does that lesson really hit home?
I think it probably starts to hit home once a little bit after university, a couple of years after university probably, when you're not in the job exactly that you were hoping to be in. You're not doing quite as well as you thought you might. And also I think maybe when you you get married and have kids and realize that there are day-to-day challenges in all of this and that the focus needs to be so much on that day-to-day and much less on the horizon of possibilities. And that you're going to make your possibilities in tomorrow as opposed to a year from now or 5 years from now. And probably by the time, you know, that we're in our mid-30s, you know, we're along some path. And by the early 40s, have something of an understanding that this is kind of the path of my life. And for the most part, and I think is that it's like, it's okay. It's an all right path. It's not the path that I thought I would be on, but actually I kind of like this path. And I think for most people, that's what happened. I know that like when I was playing with the Canadians, I mean, all of a sudden out of nowhere, I'm playing with the Montreal Canadiens. We're traveling around the US playing US teams and often, you know, where fellow classmates at Cornell are. And they would, you know, make contact with me when I would be in town. The first couple of years that I would run into them was kind of fun. You know, we were just out of college together. Then by the late 20s, it wasn't so much fun because they were finding themselves not quite where they wanted to be, and they saw me as if I was where I wanted to be, and that made us that much different, and that they needed to pretend, and pretending wasn't fun. Then after that, it started to become good again. It was that they were the real them. I was the real me. And then we could, you know, find a way of dealing with each other that way.
But your career is fascinating for a couple of reasons. Number one, because of the incredible success you have as a professional hockey player. But then, of course, that career is over at age 31. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for another career right. at a time when all of your classmates are just sort of ramping up into theirs.
That's right.
I want to pluck something out of the book here that I suspect a lot of people don't know about. They know about the 6 Stanley Cups you won with the Habs, Team Canada 1972, Calder Trophy for the best rookie, Conn Smythe Trophy for the best player in the playoffs, 5 Vezinas for the best goaltender during the regular season. Where on that list of accomplishments would you put the events of March 20th, 1971, when you were in goal for the Habs and a guy named Dave Dryden was in goal for the Buffalo Sabres?
Well, it was special. And I mean, it was special for a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, Dave's 6 years older than me, and he was who I wanted to be. I mean, he could do everything that I wanted to do. I mean, he could catch a puck, you know, when I would go off my wrist or something. He could field a ground ball in a way in which I could. He could throw a curveball, you know, when I couldn't throw a curveball, and so, you know. He just did what I wanted to do. So finally, you know, he was with Chicago, then he was with Buffalo in the NHL, And here's this weird night, which I didn't realize was March the 20th in 1971. And I had just been brought up to the Canadians. And Dave was with the Sabres, and it was the first year of the Sabres, and they weren't going to make the playoffs. And so everybody knew that. And Punchimlack was the coach. And he kind of liked to see interesting, intriguing things happen. And so this might be interesting and intriguing. So he wanted for us to play against each other. But Al McNeil, our coach, it was Rogie Vachon's turn to play, and he was going to play. So that's how it started. And the odd part of is that our dad, who was in Toronto, he calls me up, Thursday night or something, and says, I think I'm going to come down for the weekend. And I said, yeah, well, come down for sure, but don't be disappointed, because I know you're going to be disappointed, because I'm not playing. And if you're just going to be here and be disappointed, then you may as well stay home. Well, I think I'm going to come. So the game begins, and I'm on the bench, and Dave starts the game, but then he's brought to the bench when Imlach sees that I'm not playing. First period, we're just sitting on the bench, looking at each other. Early in the second period, Rogie Vachon gets hurt. I go in. As soon as I go in, Dave goes in. So for almost two periods, and our dad is there.
How come not your mom?
She had a hard time watching games. I mean, it was classic watching her and hearing about her. That if the rink was this way and she's watching the rink, and I'm in one end and Dave is in the other, she'd be like this. And she would kind of look up a little bit when she had a sense that the puck was out of our zone and not in Dave's zone. So she'd follow it in mid-ice, but then we'd be back down like this. Until finally she sort of asked the two of us if it was okay if she didn't come.
You say that Dave was kind of your hero and he was the guy you wanted to be, but you surpassed him in every way imaginable in your professional careers. Both the teams you played for, the individual accomplishments you achieved that he did not. How awkward did that get at a certain point?
I don't think it did, because Dave wouldn't allow it to be awkward. And I wouldn't either, but he's the one who made it work. And the other part of it is that in terms of goaltending, that we did better than the Buffalo Sabres did. Dave was a teacher, and Dave went back to be a teacher, and he became an elementary school teacher after his hockey career. Then he became a vice principal. Then he became a principal. And I'm not sure that there are too many jobs that have more of an effect on more people than a teacher's job. And Dave was as special a teacher in school as he was to me and everyone else. So, that if you're sort of drawing achievement lines, look there.
Okay. He died not that long ago.
That's right.
Which I suspect is one of the reasons you're having a little trouble talking about him right now. Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. I want to ask you about something quite tragic here. You and I have a couple of things in common, actually. We're both born in Hamilton, and the first classmates of ours to die were both lost to suicide, mm-hmm. Your case and mine. To this day, 45 years later in my case, I don't know why that happened. Mm-hmm. The young woman in our case was beautiful, brilliant, seemed to have everything going for her, and at age 18, for whatever reason, she was lost to suicide. In your case, it's a guy named Craig McGregor. Do you know, all these years later, why he was lost to suicide?
No. And I asked our other classmates as well, and they don't know. And I couldn't find any surviving family members that his parents would have passed away. None of us knew whether he had brothers or sisters. And so we don't know. And we don't even know for sure that it was suicide. It was, you know, it's kind of understood to be, but that was as much as we know.
It still infuriates me that it happened and that I don't know why it happened. Right. Does it bother you?
Yeah, this book is about, like, why did stuff happen? I mean, for all 35 of us, I mean, you know, how did it happen? Why did it happen? What made it happen? Why didn't something else happen? And so it's the same for Craig as for the rest of us. And I mean, I think that's the fascination of this kind of inquiry. And I think, you know, we all do it and we all go through it. Is, you know, like, why are you sitting here? How the heck did you get here from that, you know, boyhood in Hamilton? You know, what was the path that got you here? And it could have been a whole lot of other paths. And it could have been moments. I mean, there could have been moments that absolutely would have shifted you way off to something else, and that wouldn't have turned out very well at all. That was the fun of this book. And the thing that was also funny is that I thought about writing this book for about the last 30 years. This was the time to write it. This was the age to write it. This was the time at which, you know, that you have fewer other things to do. I mean, most everybody else is retired. And you wonder things like this. Is that, man, how did I get here? And so these long, long conversations I had with each of my classmates, they were a mutual puzzling through. I mean, this wasn't as if we started with answers and somebody was just sort of spewing out the answer that they had rehearsed, you know, for 30 years to a friend who happened to ask the question. It's like, no, you know, you start maybe with a glib answer, but then the longer you talk, glib doesn't work. And so really, what happened and how and why?
That may help explain my next question, which was going to be, you didn't necessarily stay in touch with all of these people through the years, and therefore you weren't necessarily on an intimate friendship basis with many of them, and yet they're spilling their guts to you about deeply personal stuff. Mm-hmm. How come?
Because I think that you know, we're all wondering. Mm-hmm. You know, we all don't know, we're all wondering, and that we knew each other well enough in high school to kind of have an idea of whether we are comfortable with the other person or not, whether we trust the other person or not, you know, that you know, to a point, you know, at least. And then it's kind of earning it through the conversations, you know, back and forth. Mm-hmm. And again, this was probably 12, 14 hours with each person and over an extended period of time. And so that we'd talk every 2 weeks, you know, each individually. And within those 2 weeks, there'd be a lot of thinking that would be going on before the next conversation.
Let's do one more excerpt from the book. Those of us in the brain class haven't lived in traditional heroic times. We fought no great wars, survived no great depressions. Greatness wasn't asked of us or forced upon us. Greatness was an option. As I read that, I wondered, do you wish you had lived in more consequential times?
I don't know how to answer. I mean, you know, it'd be easy to that more consequential times, you know, would probably suggest world wars, and are those the times that one wants to live through? I mean, I think that the big interesting part of our times was that is that what do you do, I guess, when you don't live in historically consequential times or big headline like consequential times, and when at a time when in fact you can kind of determine to a significant extent what those times are going to be. They're not forced upon you by other countries and your own deciding to go to war or through depression, And so, you know, that what we were, more than, you know, being described as baby boomers, we were post-war kids. That's who we were. That's, if anything, that's what was the defining feature of us. We were born mostly in 1947, a few in 1946, and as I said earlier, into a Canada that was looking to find out what we are and what we might be. And so much of the thinking, you know, and reading magazines and newspapers and a sense and a feeling of a time through the 50s was this was a country that was going to be. Whatever we are now, we were actually a place that was going to be. The big, you know, the development of the North, the development of you know, finding oil in Leduc, Alberta, the aluminum company plant in Arvida, Quebec, the St. Lawrence Seaway, the building of, you know, I mean, all of these things were going to be us. The question was, is that if you have a chance to be almost anything, what are you? What do you become? And I think that's the difficulty of it, in a sense, is that why weren't we more? Why, like, we thought the suburbs were fabulous. People now look back on the suburbs and they turn up their noses and say, oh, you know, it's every house is the same. That's not how it seemed to us. That's not how it seemed to our parents. This was this amazing new place, new houses, new, you know, churches, new playgrounds, new arenas, space, green. I mean, all of that stuff. And so what does one do with those kinds of possibilities? And do we think great thoughts? Do we all become philosophers? Do we all ditch rock and roll music and love the classics? I mean, and because we didn't do all of those things, and because essentially all that came out of that time was something that was better for more people. And what's wrong with better for more people? I think that's probably the biggest accomplishment, you know, really of this generation.
Mr. Dryden, I'm saving for last the question you are going to like the least, but here we go. And I'll set it up by doing this. I remember Stephen Harper was in that chair many years ago. He was actually coming through town to go to a high school reunion. Mm-hmm. And I think he actually went to high school in Etobicoke.
He did, he went to Richview.
Okay. And I think I asked him, what's it like when you're the Prime Minister of Canada and you walk into your high school reunion? And he said, well, not too many people come up to you and ask, so what are you doing these days? Okay, all of which is to say, it is inevitable that classmates will sort of unofficially compare how everybody's doing to everybody else. And when they do that, okay, it seems inevitable to me, and you'd never put it this way, but I am. As you compare yourself and your successes to everybody else in your class, it's impossible for you not to come away and think, if this were a contest, I win. You've had one hell of a life. Do you agree with me? And I don't mean just the outcome, I mean the premise as well. Do you agree with the premise that people compare and contrast and that they all agree unanimously, you won?
If you put it that way and you know, others, you know, that they would bring me up as an example. The thing that, and it's why I write these books, the way I wrote the game, every other sports book, entertainment book, political book that I ever read had to do with how people who live in that world live in a world apart. And that in writing that book, what you're doing is you're sharing with the rest of the world who will never live in the specialness of that, that you give them an opportunity to experience that world. That's not how it felt to me. That's why I wrote the game as I wrote it. I thought that the experiences that I had were very similar, you know, to anyone else's experience. It's growing up, having dreams dashed, having friends, having people you wished who were friends that aren't friends, all the rest of that. That's what the essence of the details, some of those were different. But the essence of the day-to-day wasn't any different from that of the reader. I think that's why that book took off. And instead of it just being read by people who are interested in hockey or sports, people who weren't and didn't think that they could be, they kind of sensed that that maybe they could understand that world. I wrote a book called The Moved and the Shaken about a guy who everyone else would describe as an average person. And same thing, you know, there's something interesting about that story. How did he get, you know, to where he is? What is he thinking? What, you know, his kids, all the rest of it.
Just to explain the title, he was not a mover and shaker.
He was not a mover
and shaker. He was moved and shaken.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Going back to a high school and trying to understand, you know, the kids who were in that high school. And all of these are the same. Like, you know, the people that, you know, like, one of the, in conversation, people will always say to me, like, you're grilling me with this question and that question and the other, and I want to talk, you know, and it's like, no, I'm actually not grilling. I at least I don't feel like I'm grilling. I just want to know more about you. You all want to know about me. I mean, the reporter's doing all the rest of it. I am tired of me. I am bored of me. There's nothing interesting, you know, in that way. There's something that's interesting in you. And I want to know what it is. And I know that there is. And the other 34 people in that class are really interesting.
And that's why they deserved an almost 500-page book. Mm-hmm. There is a story there. That's Ken Dryden, and the name of the book is The Class, a memoir of a place, a time, and us. Thanks for this.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.